selecting the armed forces live so it will show, right?
Yep. That's good. Are we muted?
Yes.
I can hear you, Doug.
You can? On the mics?
In my, yeah, headphones.
We are muted in the meeting. Not sure why you hear me on headset.
I wonder if our microphones? It'd be turned off though. Oh, the test fire mic is on.
Right, they're all on.
Yeah.
But we're muted in the meeting.
Even our.
So maybe that must be it. You're hearing the mic internally, but not in the meeting. Right? Because the mics were all on and the red lights on.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that would explain that.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
It's not hot yet, it's white.
Okay.
And you can't see their name tag. One of them has a name played out.
Where are you talking about that white light?
Oh, in the picture.
At the video.
Yeah, in the ceiling, you can kind of see this. I'm guessing that's it. See teams, the teams camera.
Oh,
yeah. But you can't read it, but you can see it. I can't even read it. It looks like BS and C.
This meeting of the Joint Armed Services Committee will now come to order. The time is now 1:01 p.m. on Wednesday, November 12, 2025. We are meeting in the Denali Room of the Anchorage Legislative Information Office Building. The following members are present.
This meeting of the Joint Armed Services Committee will now come to order.
Representative,
the time is now 1:01 p.m. on Wednesday, November 12, 2025. We are meeting in the Denali
public
Room
member,
of the Anchorage Legislative Information Office Building. The following members are present.
And Brigadier General Julio Banez. And myself, Representative Ray, Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I would like to recognize staff supporting today's meeting. LIO staff Dana Nicholas, Ian Trimbley, and Tristan Williams. In Juno from Senate Records is Carrie.
Myself, Representative Ray.
I ask everyone to please silence their cell phone.
I would like to recognize
the
staff supporting
the agenda today.
LIO staff Dana Nicholas,
Department of Military and Veteran Affairs on efforts with Typhoon
Juno. From Senate Records
I
is
see
to
Director Fisher online.
Ask everyone to please silence
We are also expecting
first on the agenda
Deputy Commissioner
today
Colonel
is
Craig
an update
Christensen,
from the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs on
hey, Director Fisher
with Typhoon
and Brigadier
I
General Brian Kyle, Commander
Director
of the Alaska
Fisher
Air National
online.
Guard. I guess while we're waiting for the other two, I'll turn
Colonel
it over
Craig
to you, Director Fisher.
Hey, Director Fisher. And,
thank you,
Brigadier
Mr. Chair.
General
Good afternoon,
Brian
members
Kyle,
of the Joint Armed Services Committee. For the record, Brian Fisher, Director of the Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Emergency
two,
Management in the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
Fisher.
I'm also what's called the State Coordinating Officer and Governor's Office.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members of the Joint Armed Services Committee. For the record, Brian Fisher,
One other thing, okay,
I'm sorry.
Director
Fisher, I need to call an at ease for audio difficulties.
I'm also
one
what's called the state coordinating officer and governor's authorized representative for the disaster response in Western Alaska.
Okay,
wanted to
take
a few brief minutes to.
I'm so sorry, Director Fisher. I need to call an at ease for audio difficulties. One moment. At ease.
Back on the record, we had an audio issue, and we're hoping that it's fixed. I will also mention that we have committee member Senator Bill Walkowski joining us online now, and Senator Kelly Merrick joining us online. We also have present in person Senator L.B. Gray Jackson, and also online Representative Julie Colon. And we will go back to Director Fisher. You can put yourself back on the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Brian Fisher, the Director of the Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management in the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and the State Coordinating Officer and Governor's Authorized Representative for this disaster that we're responding to and recovering from out west.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record,
I wanted to take a moment to update the committee on our activities to date. Most of you know I've been doing this for 31 years for the state, and I will characterize this disaster as the worst that I have seen in my 31 years of service. Just to paint a picture, we're sitting right now somewhere around over 650 homes in Western Alaska, primarily in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region. That are either destroyed or have suffered major damage.
Just to paint a picture, we're sitting right
we have upwards of 700 individuals and households that have been displaced from their communities.
In Western Alaska,
many of them are in South Central right now, staying in hotels that we are providing. And we will be moving them to longer-term temporary housing solutions over winter. Unfortunately, there are many individuals and families that won't be able to return home to their communities this winter, so we'll be working hand-in-hand with the Federal Emergency Management Agency on longer-term solutions over winter to get out and continue to repair critical infrastructure in the communities as well as repair homes that need either to be replaced or repaired as a result of this disaster. I think many of you are aware the our armed services, including the Alaska Army and Air National Guard, the United States Coast Guard,
really did some heroic efforts in rescuing folks in the immediate aftermath of primarily Typhoon Halong. We're dealing with a couple of storms that came in before that, but primarily during Typhoon Halong and the destruction that we, and devastation we saw in places like Sihanouk and Quinguilaguk. There were hoist rescues, picture, if you will, kind of Hurricane Katrina, where people were being rescued off of their rooftops. Overlay that, some of the homes were washed away and either floating out to the Bering Sea or upriver inland because of the severe storm surge that happened. So the heroic efforts of our soldiers, airmen, and sailors doing those rescues was really something like I've never seen in this state before. Since that time, it's really been an all-hands-on-deck state and federal partner response to the communities impacted by the storms. That includes the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities and their contractors continuing to this day to make emergency repairs to vital community infrastructure, boardwalks, board roads, power plants, water treatment plants, sewage lagoons, as well as doing some temporary repairs to homes to try to get people's homes, if they're still in place, safe and secure and habitable for the winter. It includes the Department of Natural Resources and the Division of Forestry and Fire Protection, who are out there helping us muck out and gut homes, rip out wet insulation and replace those to get those homes habitable for the winter. The Alaska Organized Militia, which, as you all know, is comprised of the Alaska Army, Army National Guard, Air National Guard, the Alaska State Defense Force, and the Alaska Naval Militia, continue to be on the ground throughout the impact area, continuing with assessments on homes, as well as some of these what we call muck and gut missions, cleaning out homes and removing wet insulation and plywood and repairing those for an emergency winterization program. The Department of Environmental Conservation and all divisions have been fully engaged in the field, both looking at potential household hazardous waste, petroleum spills from uprighted home heating fuel tanks, looking at the landfills as well as the water and wastewater systems and sewage lagoons with their contractors. So it really is an all hands on deck response that's out there. The governor declared a state disaster emergency from the North Slope borough all the way down to the Kuskokwim Delta. And then President Trump, at the governor's request, declared a federal disaster for the Northwest Arctic borough and the lower Yukon and lower Kuskokwim regional educational attendance areas. We're right now assessing impacts throughout other areas of the region, including the Yukon-Koyukuk regional education attendance area for potential inclusion in the federal disaster. My team is working on that right now, and based on the impacts we see, we may be requesting additional areas to be included in the federal disaster. Our primary mission now is really taking care of the displaced survivors, no matter where they are. There are many in the region still staying with friends and family. Like I said, we have upwards of 650 folks that are in what we call non-congregate sheltering. An incredible effort. You all saw the pictures of C-17 from the Alaska Air National Guard full of survivors that were evacuated to Anchorage. We had them in two congregate shelter locations. My thanks to the University of Alaska, Anchorage, and the Alaska Airlines Center, and the municipality of Anchorage and the Egan Center that we used as temporary congregate shelters. We've moved all of those folks into hotel units at this point. Additional survivors are coming into Anchorage, and we're placing them directly in hotels temporarily. And then our big effort working with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the regional tribal housing authorities, and commercial property owners around the state is to move these folks into long-term temporary housing over winter using some federal programs under the federal disaster to make sure that they have a warm, safe place to stay. The Department of Education and Early Development and the Anchorage School District and many school districts around the state have welcomed these survivors into their schools. So I'm very thankful for Dr. Bryant and the folks at ASD and Mayor LaFrance and the municipality of Anchorage for supporting the largest population of displaced survivors, which is here in the Anchorage area. But it's really happening everywhere, with Tenenbaum Chiefs Conference in Fairbanks, down to the Kenai Peninsula, to the Matsu Borough. We have folks everywhere, and everybody has been incredibly gracious with hosting these families and, in some cases, pets that have been evacuated from the area. As I said, our emergency repairs continue throughout the region now, and when that slows down, because it will be, at some point it will be unsafe to work due to winter temperatures and weather out there. We'll be planning a big effort to finalize the repair of damaged facilities and damaged homes throughout the summer next year. So I'll stop there, Mr. Chair, and available for any questions. Thank you very much for the time today.
Thank you so much, Director Fisher, and thank you so much for your hard work since this disaster happened and for all of the work that our folks have been engaged in to fix some of the damage and help those folks who've been displaced. My question is, can you talk a little bit about specifically how many National Guard service members have been involved in the disaster response?
Chair, to the chair, for the record, Brian Fisher. We've had over 200 service members from the organized militia, including the State Defense Force and the Naval Militia, either supporting here in Anchorage at the Joint Operations Center next to the State Emergency Operations Center, in Bethel, helping coordinate all the logistics and transportation of folks throughout the YK region, and then specifically in the villages that were supporting repair efforts and cleanup efforts. So it's been well over 200 since the start of the storms. That includes in Kotzebue, the Northwest Arctic Borough, from the first storm that hit about a week before Halong did, helping to temporarily repair homes up there so folks can stay in the Kotzebue area from that storm.
And my follow-up to that is, how quickly were we able to mobilize those folks?
Thank you to the chair. Pretty much immediately. As I mentioned, the rescue efforts, that all occurred immediately under the authority of our two rescue coordination centers with the United States Coast Guard in Juneau and the Air Force Rescue Coordination Center in Anchorage. So those rescue operations happened immediately. And through the governor's authorities, through his disaster declaration, we were able to place soldiers and airmen and sailors on state active duty orders pretty much immediately. As we identified needs throughout the region, we were able to bring more and more soldiers, airmen, and sailors on active duty orders with the state to deploy forward and out west to support the needs of all the communities and survivors.
And my last follow-up is, how many folks are still on orders, and how long do we expect them to remain on orders?
To the chair, I'll have to get the specific numbers back to the committee after this. We expect pretty continual effort through at least Thanksgiving, and that's kind of all hands on deck, not just the Alaska Army and Air Guard and the organized militia, but the other agencies that are out there responding. But at some point, we'll curtail that a bit because we won't be able to do some of these temporary winterization or emergency repairs, and then we will be able to relook at the needs come this spring when the barges start sailing, and there may be potential for additional service members to be placed on state active duty again in the spring and summer to support our recovery efforts.
Thank you so much. And again, thanks for the hard work you're doing. I'll open it up to the committee for any further questions.
Good afternoon, Director Fisher. This is Bob Dole, a public member of the committee. First off, I think it's great that we have a state coordinating officer in place who is also in place for Galena and can fully understand the challenges ahead. Probably never thought Galena would be a preparatory activity for this. In looking at the response to the disaster, probably pivotal to the successful response was the ability to leverage aviation, both the C-17 transport and Army National Guard aviation. Particularly, I think the call out is the CH-47's new capacity, relatively speaking, that medium lift. Do you see continuing authority to utilize National Guard aviation to support efforts in Western Alaska?
Through the chair to Mr. Dole, thank you for the question. For the record, Brian Fisher. We'll be slowly curtailing the military aviation support that's out there. As I think you're well aware, the Alaska Air Carriers Association and our private sector aviation partners have an incredibly robust capability out there. For example, the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities has contracted for a private Chinook, if you will, CH-47, to be able to do some of the sling load operations for us. We utilize the military aircraft pretty extensively in the emergency response phase to make sure we're taking care of survivors and transporting people and materials everywhere. And we're slowly transitioning back into that private sector model. So I won't see a huge need for military aviation support through the winter and probably not next summer. That'll most likely be a maritime lift with our commercial maritime transporters to get all the building materials and heavy equipment out for the repair effort next summer.
Thank you. Representative Nelson. And thank you, Director Fisher. This is Representative Nelson. My question is kind of along those same lines about National Guard Aviation. I imagine over the course of the past couple months, there's been quite an increase on flight hours and knowing how much those cost for the National Guard. Do we have an idea of there's any concern on funding limitations further down the line for next year or for the upcoming summer, especially related to wildlife or rescue operations?
Through the chair, Representative Nelson, thanks for the question. I don't have any immediate concerns about funding at all, whether it's commercial or military aviation support. With the president's declaration for the area, a large portion of the cost that we incurred early on for all of the support, whether it was for the armed forces folks, the Alaska Army and Air Guard, and the organized militia, including their aviation, will be reimbursable through the federal government under the federal disaster that's there. Again, I don't see a concern right now for the funding necessary to continue operations for the remainder of repairs that will have to happen, some over winter, but mostly in the spring and summer next year. Right now, I think we're in good shape. We're in constant contact with the congressional delegation about the Federal Disaster Relief Fund and, of course, working with the governor and OMB on our funding on the state side for that. But largely, we'll have a significant amount of funding reimbursable by the federal government for this disaster, which we're grateful for.
Yeah, Director Fisher, this is George Michaelis. Just a quick question. In lieu of the fact that this occurrence could show up again in that area, in all probability, what mitigation efforts are being recommended and taken to help preclude this type of disaster in the future?
Through the chair, Mr. Michaelis, thank you. For the record, Brian Fisher. One of the things that we're fixing to go into a meeting with the Native Village of Kipnuk and their tribal council in just a few moments. And one of the things that we are sharing with all of the communities impacted is where authorized by federal and state law and our disaster recovery programs, we intend to include mitigation in those activities. And that could be, and I know Mr. Dole saw this in Galena, things like elevating homes as we rebuild or repair them to prevent future flooding disaster. The same thing with infrastructure. We're working directly with Commissioner Anderson and DOT to look at the ability to install helical piles under the board roads and boardwalks in these communities to make sure that they survive additional storms that will be coming in the future. I can say that the performance of elevated homes in Kipnuk and Quinguilinguk, boardwalks that were previously installed with mitigation in mind with steel heel piling foundations, survived fairly well. So as we are continuing to repair infrastructure damaged by these storms, we're going to be looking at building them taller, building the sewage lagoon berms higher and stronger to survive future storms. And I know there's a lot of consideration by the communities about, a longer-term conversation about relocation. But where we can and where the funding is authorized, we're going to be mitigating as we do repairs because we know additional storms will happen in the future.
Thank you.
Director Fisher, I'm curious. You talked about 200 folks who've been involved, but, some from the Alaska Defense Force, some from the Army National Guard, some airmen involved. Are you able to sort of talk about the numbers of the different components? And I'm curious specifically about using guard members who live in the area. Were they the bulk of the folks who were responding, or were we flying folks out from Anchorage?
Thank you. For the record, Brian Fisher, it's a combination of both folks that are in place in Western Alaska. There are a lot of soldiers from the Alaska State Defense Force that are out there, as well as bringing in folks from Anchorage or other areas of the state to be mobilized on state active duty orders to be out there. What I can say is this response has really been incredible with the organized militia. So when I had a need or our communities had a need for some kind of work to respond or recover to this disaster, I really couldn't tell the difference. And to me and the civilians that are overseeing the response and recovery, what component they're from, really what uniform they're wearing, was kind of transparent to us. It was kind of a whole effort from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, coordinated by the Alaska Army and Air National Guard, but with soldiers and sailors from the State Defense Force and Naval Militia. We can certainly get back to the committee about the breakdown of service members from each of the components on the state side. I'm happy to provide that back to the committee as a follow-up. But I think the great perspective for me doing this for all these years is that it's really, it didn't matter what component they were from. They were all hands on deck and just incredible amount of heart from our volunteers, giving up their day jobs to go on state active duty to help our fellow Alaskans in need.
And I'm very grateful for their service. My last question in that vein is, was 200 sufficient, or if more people had volunteered, would they have been able to go on orders as well? Or was it really you had spots for 200 volunteers and we met the need? Or if 300 had volunteered, would you have taken 300?
Thanks for the question. It met the requirements that we had throughout the kind of life cycle of this disaster. So wouldn't have taken people that wanted to volunteer unless we had meaningful work for them to do out there. So it was absolutely sufficient. As we surged forces, we continued to receive volunteers from all the components. And that number that we had out there, because it wasn't really just a military response, it was all the other state, federal volunteer partners working in conjunction with the Association of Village Council Private Presidents and the Regional Housing Authority and other entities out there. We had sufficient forces for the need that we had as we discovered, you know, additional damages or additional repair work that might happen. Absolutely sufficient for my needs.
Thank you. General Banez.
Hi, Director Fisher. This is Randy Banez. Just a quick question on U.S. Coast Guard participation in the event.
Thank you, through the chair, Ms. Banez. As I stated earlier, they were significantly involved in the rescue operations immediately following the impacts from Typhoon Halong. They also worked directly, you know, every single day, but in this disaster specifically, the environmental side of the U.S. Coast Guard, along with our Department of Environmental Conservation, to go do assessments of waterways and hazardous materials and oil spills. They also assisted us and the owners and operators of our utilities throughout the impact area, making sure that the bulk fuel storage tanks were still in a good condition, that they weren't compromised, that marine fuel headers were still available for bulk fuel transfers and all that. So, and then they did an amazing amount of assessment work, flyovers and footage and assessments, not only of infrastructure of concern for them, but home infrastructure, those kind of things as well. So the Arctic District, as well as sector Western Alaska, the U.S. Arctic, really had a significant role very early on in the disaster. They're still working with the Department of Environmental Conservation on the normal stuff that they do for marine habitat and the marine transportation system and any pollution response events that are out there. But it just is a tremendous amount of coordinated support through the State Emergency Operations Center in support of those communities.
And I'd like to offer the opportunity to ask a question to anyone online. Also, Senator Gray Jackson, if you want to come up to the table and ask questions at any time, you're welcome to. And anyone online have any questions for Director Fisher about the Typhoon Halong response? Seeing none, and everyone on the committee feel good. Director Fisher, thank you so much for being here today. Thanks again for this massive coordinated response to this terrible disaster, and thank you for your continued efforts. We sincerely appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. So we'll move on to the second item on our agenda today. I will ask my staff, Kyle Johansson, to come up. Basically, we're going to continue our discussion about rewriting the statute that governs Joint Armed Services Committee. A couple of comments since our last meeting. Most states have a Military and Veterans Affairs Committee, like we do. The Alaska House's Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs, their purpose is to consider and make recommendations on legislation related to military and veterans affairs in Alaska. We did talk at that meeting in August about the Alaska Military Affairs Commission, which is a newly established commission by legislation sponsored by Representative Will Stapp out of Fairbanks. That commission is within the executive branch. It's headed by the Lieutenant Governor, and they advise the governor, state agencies, and the legislature on military issues and economic development related to the military presence in Alaska. There is no other state in our country that has a permanent Joint Armed Services Committee. So I'm curious about what role this committee should play in the future so that we're not being duplicative over the House Special Military and Veterans Affairs Committee and the newly established Alaska Military Affairs Commission. What my staff has done is basically taken the original statute that we had from 1999, drafted by Alaska State House Representative at the time, Lisa Murkowski's office. It basically said that our purpose was to make advisements regarding base realignment and closure. We felt that base realignment and closure has not been what this committee has been doing for a while, so we've deleted that language out so that it's not one long litany of base realignment and closure statutes. But purpose now, and I just want to open it for discussion, is what should we replace that base realignment and closure language with? And I am here to work.
Nelson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you don't see in the future, if we were to change JASC, you don't see term the BRAC hearings?
Well, I mean, I guess we could have the BRAC hearings. Representative Nelson, if we're not having BRAC hearings, what should the Joint Armed Services Committee do?
So the BRAC hearings are federal. So what I was saying is, why don't we have something in here? Because they haven't been happening for a decade or two, but that doesn't mean that they won't eventually come back. Sure. I mean, it was just in 2016 that we could have lost the paratrooper element up here in Alaska. So there is still that little bit. I would just personally like to see that still, maybe not to the extent of the statute, but still have that, at least a little bit of section in there.
Mr. Chairman, just to add some some context, BRAC, when it basically ended, Congress made it so Congress would have to have a proactive action to reestablish BRAC. So it's basically mothballed. But I think General Vakalis had mentioned that it is very important that we keep at least one element of BRAC to remind Alaska, don't forget, this is still out there. And so that's, I think, since it's getting at, it's not going away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think if we base realignment and closure is kind of somewhat a term of art. Maybe if we did something broader to address Representative Nelson, like proposed force structure changes or realignment or mission changes, that might be a better fit where we look to the USAR Act transformed to the 11th Airborne, but also the threat to the both at Eielson, previously with fighters, and with the attempted downsizing of the USAR. I think force structure changes will probably be a better focus area than BRAC, and that allows us also to address internal Department of War deliberations for Congress. So.
I would certainly agree with that. Yeah, I do think we have to have something in here because it could very well come back again. You know, it happened four times. So.
Sir? You can come up and put yourself on the record.
Yeah.
My name is Chris Nelson, and I was the first staff director of JASC. The JASC was an outgrowth of what's called the Joint Task Force on Military Issues, which was formed for BRAC specifically. Post-BRAC, other issues came forward, primarily missiles, and the Joint Task Force on Military Bases was formed under the Legislative Council. It was decided that a standing permanent committee, joint committee of the legislature should do that. And so I drafted the BRAC statute. And I bet your staff, I'd welcome the chance to be with them and be a resource to share what our thinking was, all of that. The JASC was proactive and almost immediately went after the Missile Defense Mission. It was very active, advocating to get missile defense. At that point in time, we really didn't know it was going to go to really, although we felt we had locations here that would be appropriate. So select that. We also wanted to do one of the things that other states were doing to advocate more missions coming into Alaska. Colonel Michaelis has mentioned it first. There's always force structure changes which drive base structure changes. So the idea that there will not be future considerations to realign activities at certain bases. Operating bases is costs an awful lot of money. Colonel was the garrison commander for the bases in Alaska at the time of his retirement. And one of the things we put into the JASC is the non-legislative members who really bring a vast sum of experience that they share with us. But the JASC went after missions, the missile defense missions. I think it was about 10 years ago, Senator Rilichowski talked to the consultants that we had hired for BRAC 95 and got a very good proposal outlining some of the things that could be done if we had hired a Washington-based consultant. I think it would be worthwhile for the committee to revisit that and take a look at it. Missions are changing. The worlds are changing. There are opportunities for us to bring more military missions and military forces to the state because we're uniquely prepared to do that. We also, things are changing. When I first was assigned to Alaska as an Army Reserve officer in the Command Operations Center in U.S. Army Alaska in 1973, we actually had a threat from the Soviet Union. We do have a mission to defend Alaska today that had lapsed after the end of the Cold War. So there are a variety of things. Another thing the JASC used to do was to try to get members of the legislature more closely involved and see what the military is doing. We used to do base tours during the interim, and we had tours here at Fort Greeley. It's been a few years. I think the last time we went to Fort Greeley was 2008, 2009, and I don't know if any of you would have the chance to be really see the missile field there. See the operations there that it's actually run by members of the Alaska Army National Guard. I don't think anybody's been to ADAC for a while, but there's talk about bringing that back in with the Navy, and that'll be a complicated process. But all of these kinds of things are doing that, and so that's what the JASC did. So I welcome the chance to work with your staff, share what little I know at any time. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Nelson, and thanks for your work back in 1999. Mr. Caleb.
Yeah, one of the other things that the JASC was involved in is when the Air Force was trying to open up more air corridors for training.
Mm-hmm.
So the JASC was involved in that, working with the FAA, supporting the Air Force's efforts to do that. And of course, now they do have more air corridors for training. So,
thank you. I was just going to spell out a little bit more, because something that's different, and it's a very recently passed legislation of this 15-member commission, including members of the public, which is the Alaska Military Affairs Commission, headed by the Lieutenant Governor, that its goals include expanding the military's presence, maximizing federal investment, and supporting military families and veterans. I hear talking about missile defense, and President Trump has proposed the Golden Dome. It's potentially $75 billion that would be at Fort Greeley. I mean, I can definitely see that being an issue that maybe JASC talks about that wouldn't be appropriate for Alaska Military and Military Affairs Commission. Maybe it's not something that would come to the House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee. So maybe, but I think what we could do is try to frame our language more broadly speaking to encompass Golden Dome and potential future base realignment and closure. But I mean, I'm thinking like that's what we need to do.
You just created more work for your staff. As a former staffer, you know.
Just for timeline purposes, Mr. Chairman, hoping to get a draft to Let's Legal by the first of the year to get introduced by the 21st, the opening of session. So next 30 or 40 days would be really timely to get these issues.
One of the things that, and Kyle and I talked about this, I did meet with key people at Helmut Olaf and Port Richardson, and tried to figure out what areas where the JASC could help in the future. And there's a whole list of things that they gave us. And in reading the document here, if we made it generic enough, we could probably include most of those things because they're all relevant and they're all really things that do affect readiness. So,
do you have that list?
I
gave it to Kyle.
I gave it to Kyle.
Okay. I think it's ironic that I feel like I'm the person speaking for smaller. I think the thing that I'm just concerned with is no other state having one. And we have this Military and Affairs Commission, which has just started, which hasn't even met yet. And so it's just me trying to make sure that we iron out a specific mission for this committee that doesn't, it's not going to be duplicative. And so that's kind of where my frame of thinking is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So looking at this overall, would you then intend to say that the House Special Committee on Military Veterans Affairs go away and replacement for JASC?
No. I think that we need the House, that's the committee that does all the legislation. JASC hasn't ever really done legislation. We have public members, they're House and Senate at the same time, so we don't do any legislation. That committee needs to exist in order to review legislation. I think that committee is definitely safe. Representative Staff is in the air right now. I spoke to him just anything about this specific issue about, you know, what is the purpose of his commission and making sure that there's not overlap. Kyle and then.
Okay. Well, I mean, the Senate doesn't have a Military Veterans Affairs, as you well noted, but they still are able to introduce legislation. They go through, I believe, State Affairs. Senator Gray Jackson be able to say that a little bit more if I'm mistaken. I just have a feeling, and smaller government, as you well said, that maybe JASC could take over that idea and that purpose and then have Military Veterans Affairs be removed, or is that not what you're trying to
get? Well, as you just said, State Affairs could do it. The difference, of course, is that this is JASC is a permanent standing committee, unlike the Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs, which is created at the start of every new legislature. So, you know, nothing special has to be done for Military and Veterans Affairs to go away, so that it doesn't get established on the first day of the new legislature.
And that's what I'm asking, is that your attempt to have JASC?
I had never thought about that. I hadn't thought about JASC replacing Military and Veterans Affairs. But
I'm asking you what the intent, you know, if you want to have JASC have a broad category of duties, a lot of that is overtaking what Military and Veterans Affairs is already doing. So is that kind of your...
Well, what I hear you saying is that Senate uses State Affairs for that. I don't think that JASC can meet three times a week or, you know, as frequently enough to hear all the bills. And plus, we don't have public members hearing bills. So in other words, I don't think that JASC has anything to do with Military and Veterans Affairs in terms of that committee. What I think the most fear of overlap is in a brand new created Alaska Military Affairs Commission that has multiple public members headed by the Lieutenant Governor. That's where I worry about overlap. I'm not concerned about JASC replacing anything to do with Health Special Affairs. I'm open to ideas about what that committee should or shouldn't do. If Senate takes care of it in state affairs, maybe that's something the House can model on. But I don't think that that really affects what my fear of the duplicative nature of government by having a large commission of public members and a joint services commission.
Just very briefly, JASC is not empowered to introduce or hear legislation. So, just for clarity. Secondly, Representative Staff did testify when his bill was being passed that he felt that both entities could coexist because one of them is housed in the executive branch, one the legislative branch. Also to be cautious of overlapping, as Representative the Chairman talks about. So that is on the record from last Representative Staff's bill passed.
I have a question for Mr. Nelson. So when JASC was formed, as you said, it replaced the task force. Is that
it was called the Joint Task Force on Military Bases?
And the Joint Task Force on Military Bases, was that being that was not a? I guess how permanent was that task force? I knew it had been around for a long time.
No, it actually formed as a reaction to BRAC.
Okay.
By the time we started on BRAC 95, that was, depending on if where you start BRAC, was it, you know, in 1988, when it was in the Department of Defense or in the congressional BRAC legislation, communities were starting to put together defense teams for their local community. And Alaska was behind the curve. First of all, a lot of the communities, Stellar Junction, didn't have resources to form BRAC defense committee. That, and so it was decided primarily by Senator Tim Kelly and Representative Chernowski, stuff, and I was asked to come up and work with them specifically on BRAC. It was under the Ledge Council. It was in the interim, and the timeline on this is they were out of session, so they decided to do it with the Ledge Council. And Ledge Council could authorize contracts without going through the budget process. And so George came back with, we had a $50,000 contract that we could let a Washington representative for a BRAC team. And we went back and did people to do that. So there was a funding mechanism to use it through Ledge Council up within the limits of Ledge Council that was available. So that's why it's a matter of timing, legislature being out of session, a funding stream available to use immediately to go in and to look at all the bases in the state. It was we were involved in more communities than both states did. But there were other states who were doing things. We looked at the state of Texas, putting together their BRAC defense thing for the state and assisting a lot of local communities. When we started this whole thing, none of the communities in the states had BRAC teams. And so we stepped in back.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'd like to suggest we look at this from a different viewpoint also. If we first, I'd note that according to this economic impact, Alaska is number five for the impact on our gross domestic product military. So it is a significant opportunity or risk depending on where we're at. If we look at Alaska, many of the concerns that have been brought to us by the senior officers when they were before us are things that are within the state's jurisdiction as opposed to local jurisdictions. I'd posit that there are three recurring themes when the generals and admirals have come before us. Those are, first, where am I going to live and where's my family going to live? Housing. Second, education. Where are my kids going to go to school? Are the schools up here appropriate for my kids? Third, where's my spouse going to work? And that goes back to licensure. In Alaska, those are all significantly intertwined with legislation at the state level versus other places where it's much more a local jurisdiction issue. And I think at that role, there has to be an open communication channel between the elected members of
the legislature and those senior officers coming forward with the concerns of what they need for our bases to grow and prosper, flourish, and stay.
Whatever. Of our meetings, the Supervisor could present, ask for assistance and head if hazardous materials is it needed to, because everything has to be shipped. I think some the facilities that has to be shipped. And so, and it's just shipped down to they have a storage facility there. All the stuff. But I think what the generals are asking is there some way, rather than have a ship full of something else, and we can safely dispose of here, all the acres of the state, without harming anything. And I know that was a request to ask. I don't think it's the best. But it has come up again. So.
What I think that brings up for me is that when you have multiple entities that can respond to something, that sometimes people assume that the other entity will respond. And so I think that that's, and really, I feel like I have to tread lightly when I talk about this, but I think that JASC hasn't met the past few years. And so I think, really just coming down to what entity is going to take responsibility for these big issues and say, that is mine and I'm going to do it. And from my outsider's perspective, I felt like that it hasn't been JASC that has been recently that has been stepping up and saying, this is our responsibility. We will manage this. We will take care of that. Maybe that's what JASC should be doing. So I think having this conversation is about establishing what JASC owns and takes responsibility.
And JASC used to be pretty about quarter. And then if something immediate meeting. So just something
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I totally agree. JASC is really much dependent on the current co-chair of that time. Some co-chairs really want to invest heavily into JASC and have multiple meetings and have base visits. But over time, it's mainly become just an extra committee for people to be assigned to and have the yearly commander fly-in and briefing. And I feel, and of course, Representative Staff is on the phone, so we can't ask him, but I feel that that's part of why we have AMAC. Is because that's a little more dedicated to it and not dependent on every year or every 2 years changing up leadership and having a wide variety of personnel that are in charge of it. And even if we do extend JASC to a whole bunch of new duties and responsibilities, that still doesn't stop the fact that every year, every 2 years, new committee chairs or co-chairs will get in and they will decide how often they want to meet. They will decide if they care or not about this compared to AMAC, which has set personnel that have a dedicated interest to.
I'm curious about people's opinions about putting in statute that we like having an expectation this meeting meets more than once a year, this committee meets more than once a year. Making it so that the committee must do.
If we really want to take, do I think the original vision is active, then I would strongly suggest some type of talk that indicates the frequency. And importantly, I could say that's how it works. And we hope it's very, it's so practical. I said, there's a lot of issues out there.
There's certainly plenty of issues today justify meeting.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. one thing that may be important to think about is interaction with Washington, D.C., not to throw the delegation under the bus. We don't do that here. But they're very busy. It's very difficult to connect with their offices. And I think back earlier in JASC, they literally went to Washington, D.C. to reach out to go there personally rather than have members show up to meetings in Juneau. So that's something else I think would be really.
I'm going to jump to Representative Stutes and then to Mr. Nelson. Representative Stutes.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to mention that sometimes when people at the desk there are speaking, it's hard to hear them. So maybe
okay, they so we'll have everyone speak into their microphones. Thank you
very much.
Mr. Nelson.
Yes. Again, this kind of goes back to the BRAC statute, which was to end congressional influence over the fights on which base got cut down. So the original BRAC, you know, BRAC is a process that's on rails. You can't, you know, it, and so the congressional delegations of all states were isolated from that decision process. That still was a mission, but they couldn't do it. So one of the things that states and communities did, and one of the things that GASP did, was to be able to go in. We could go inside the building and schedule meetings. We had a consulting firm that had multiple contracts. We had we could do things that simply congressional delegation was prohibited by law from doing. So we filled a vacuum and performed a mission that they were statutorily prohibited from doing. The other thing, of course, is that after the BRAC process was over, we were directly involved in base reads. What do we do with Fort? What do we do with BRAC? And we got involved in all of those processes as well. We're at a time right now with our country's history, where the world situation is changing, the requirements for our military are changing, and you know, having an entity in place that react to it. I think the JASC is, again, perfectly positioned to do that. If there are other entities there, I don't necessarily see that being as competition. Again, we're a small state of each other, talk to each other. So the leadership in the legislature, leadership in the new, whoever the new lieutenant governor is, and sit down and talk and really put together a working plan that divides responsibilities up. That's simply a matter of leadership. But I don't see a competition between the entities. I think the public, it's not in part of the military. All of, you know, I have to leave to go out to a medical appointment at the Jake Hospital. We never quite get away from our service. But there's a large number of the population have not had service, so don't know that. We're asking them from them and make people aware of what's happening. And again, that's one of the things that being state tourism at the base is get out and meet soldiers and you know, go beyond the social functions that we're all invited to, you know, at the end of the I'm talking to some talk there.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. And thank you for your work, and we would love for you to collaborate on the new JASC statute. Any other questions or comments? So what we'll do, as far as this goes, is we will work to have more general encompassing language about this committee, along with possibly mandated meeting, and we'll look at it in January. The co-chair, Senator Kawasaki, will be the chair then, but I don't think he'll have any problem talking about that new legislation. That will conclude this section of the meeting. So third on the agenda today, we have presentations on constitutional concerns about Department of Defense policies and actions in 2025. We have two distinguished guests, and what I'm going to do is read their bios and then have them make their opening remarks, and then we can ask questions directly to both of them. That's how we'll do it. I see Colonel Moyer up. I was going to start with Colonel Farish.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, perfect. I'm going to read your bio, Colonel Fair, and then I'll have you give your statement. Karen Fair, retired Colonel Karen Fair, currently serves as General Counsel and Vice President for Improving One Life at a Time, where she provides strategic legal counsel to Fortune 500 CEOs and leads a private law practice. She is a decorated Army veteran, earning the rank of Colonel with over 25 years of leadership, including service as strategist and later Division Chief to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. On the Joint Staff, collaborating with the combatant commands, she was pivotal in drafting and implementing major U.S. policies on detainee management and international human rights compliance, serving as project manager for the Department of Defense's first doctrinal guide on detainee operations, and shaping global standards for military operations and humanitarian assistance. She has delivered congressional testimony and briefings to the Senate and House Armed Services Committees, the National Security Council, and the President's Administration. She served as General Counsel to the Commanding General, 1st Armored Division in Germany, where she led a team of over 150 legal professionals spread across Germany. Ms. Fair has served in general counsel positions during combat operations, including Somalia, Kosovo, and Iraq. Her distinguished career is recognized by awards such as the Bronze Star, 2 Legion of Merit Medals, the Joint Service Meritorious Achievement Medal, honors from the Austrian Ministry of Defense, and the American Bar Association's Outstanding Young Lawyer of the Year. In addition to her government and legal leadership, Ms. Fair has been actively involved in nonprofit and community service. She was a founding member of the Wounded Warriors and served on the currently serving advisory council to the Military Officers Association of America. She earned her Juris Doctorate at the University of Tennessee. She earned her Bachelor of Science in Engineering from the United States Military Academy at West Point with honors. She is admitted to the Tennessee State Bar, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, the Army Court of Criminal Appeals, and the U.S. Supreme Court. Colonel Fair, please put yourself on the record and begin your opening remarks.
Yes, my name is Karen Fair, and I'm thank you very much, Representative Gray, for including me in tonight's discussion about the recent politicization of the military. What people may or may not know is that the Army JAG Corps goes all the way back to 1775 when George Washington made Tudor his very first Judge Advocate General. And in this day and time, during this administration, we come together very concerned by the actions that the administration is taking, purging the officer corps within 24 hours of Pete Hegseth's nomination as the Secretary of Defense. He got rid of all of the head lawyers of the military. In addition to that, he has purged the officer ranks, which has taken away from incredible institutional knowledge that they had, all because they may or could have been connected to General Milley, who, of course, President Trump despises. And I'm just eager to dig into this tonight and to be a part of what I think is going to be a topic in our nation for some time to come once we get past this shutdown. But I'm just so humbled to be here tonight, and I thank you for inviting me, Representative Gray.
Thank you, Colonel Fair. I will now introduce Lieutenant Colonel Dan Moyer. We'll do questions after we've introduced both guests. So Dan Boyer teaches national security law, criminal law, and criminal procedure at Ohio Northern University's Claude W. Pettit College of Law. He is also a fellow with the National Institute of Military Justice and advisor for the Center for Military Law and Policy at Texas Tech University School of Law. Prior to joining ONU Law, Professor Moyer served 22 years as an active duty Army officer, first as a combat engineer and later as a judge advocate, including two combat deployments and a strategy fellowship with the Chief of Staff of the Army at the Pentagon. He has advised senior Army commanders and coached foreign partner nation military lawyers in international law and the law of armed conflict, prosecuted felony-level cases, argued appellate cases before the Army Court of Criminal Appeals and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, and was the chief prosecutor at a large Midwestern Army installation supervising and mentoring junior prosecutors. He taught constitutional and criminal law at the U.S. Military Academy West Point and various national security law subjects at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia, prior to retiring in 2024. Professor Moyer has written and co-edited two books on American civil-military relations, has published in scholarly journals like the American Criminal Law Review, Harvard National Security Journal, Journal of National Security Law and Policy, Maryland Law Review, Ohio State Journal on Dispute Resolution, and many others. Professor Moyer earned his JD from the Ohio State University and his LLM from the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. Licensed to practice in Ohio, he is also a member of the bars of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Services and the U.S. Supreme Court. Colonel Moyer, please put yourself on the record and begin your opening remarks.
Thank you, Chair Gray, members of the committee. My name is Daniel Maurer, Lieutenant Colonel Army, retired, currently Associate Professor of Law at Ohio Northern University. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you, and I apologize, Maurer. Thank you.
That's okay. No, you're not the first. So I'm prepared to talk with you today about my two biggest concerns as I look at what's been happening both within the DoD and how the military has been used or employed by the Trump administration in the last year. I see the collision of states' rights with an overbearing federal government based on nothing more than optics and reinforcing a narrative of presidential strength. And I see the collision of domestic criminal law enforcement with national security concerns. Both of these concerns are caused by two very different drivers. One, who believes the rule of law has a seatbelt or is a seatbelt, is a brake and an engine warning light. And one who thinks that no seatbelt is necessary, has a lead foot, and remains largely blind to warning lights. The first driver elevates transparency, honesty, fact, and evidence-based decisions, and good faith respect for everyone in the community. The second driver elevates appearance over substance, loyalty over merit, and strength even at the cost of respect and trust. My focused concern is on, first, the National Guard deployments over governor's objections. The administration's logic for these deployments are flatly false. First, they argue that illegal immigration is a national security threat. Two, they argue that many cities are acting like safe harbors for any and all illegal immigrants, regardless of the threat that they may pose to Americans' safety or property. Three, they argue that once in these cities, these illegal immigrants are so numerous that a broad concerted effort is necessary, a campaign, if you will. Fourth, as ICE has tried to execute their campaign, protesters are enraged or engaged in widespread violence and physically endangering ICE agents or federal property at locations where these raids occur. Fifth, they argue that these protesters are more often than not paid agitators, quote unquote, violent, and members of Antifa, what the administration is now calling a domestic terrorist organization. Therefore, the government argues, call in the National Guard. Not a single one of those premises is legally accurate, because not a single one is based on credible factual evidence. As a result, the military is being ordered into situations where they lack sufficient training and sensitivity to the constitutional rights and protections of those civilian protesters. It puts soldiers in terribly awkward positions where they must act like police and to police fellow Americans on American city streets. And because of where these deployments are happening, they get lots of publicity, which only fuels civilian dissent and more protest. This in turn increases the risk that violence erupts and that civilian protest behavior becomes misconstrued as a hostile act. It's only a matter of time before National Guard shoots excessive, use excessive, and possibly lethal force against Americans exercising their constitutional rights to assemble and to speak out against what they view as both bad policy and bad government. In short, the administration is trying to make America militarized again. The plan to create and deploy these so-called rapid reaction and quick reaction National Guard units only means that this happens more frequently and across more than just L.A., Portland, and Chicago. My second focus concern is this new war on drugs, boat strikes, and what they say about this administration's respect for and understanding of legal limits. There's no doubt that drug cartels are dangerous. They are violent, and nobody disagrees that what they do increases the risk of dangerous to Americans because of the drugs they bring in. Nobody argues otherwise. Nobody suggests that it's wrongful or that it needs a response to deter and punish. But illicit drug importation is a crime and has been for a very long time. And there are well-established criminal procedures for addressing it. In fact, the Coast Guard is literally doing law enforcement drug interdiction missions of suspected narco-terrorist vessels at the same time other suspected vessels are being destroyed along with everyone on board by Hellfire missiles launched from a drone. With no investigation, no seizure of incriminating evidence, no arrests, no prosecution or trial, just punishment. That has two names, extrajudicial killing, also known as murder. There's near universal consensus among experts in both domestic war powers and the president and international laws of war, those that we're bound to follow, like the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Conventions, that these strikes have no legal basis in federal law. Nothing in Article 2 permits it. Nothing Congress has said authorizes it. Simply designating them foreign terrorist organizations confers no legal authority to kill them. And merely saying that they pose an imminent threat to Americans doesn't make it so, especially when we do know that those boats are nowhere near U.S. shores, they're not heading toward U.S. shores, and eventually when the drugs do reach U.S. shores, they're not being forced into Americans' veins. To say that these drug cartels are deliberately aiming to harm Americans, which is the basis for the self-defense claim, is beyond common sense. A drug dealer trying to kill a drug user, his customer base, is simply not happening, nor would it ever likely be the case. Moreover, even if we are in this armed conflict with these cartels, as the president has said, the very laws of war that Trump says permit our use of lethal force actually say the opposite. There are only two types of targets in such a non-state armed conflict: organized non-state armed groups and civilians who are directly participating in hostilities. Very simply, both of those terms have definitions in the law. And under those definitions, including definitions that the U.S. DOD accepts and has accepted for a very long time, don't apply. Those cartel members are not directly participating in hostilities for the purposes of war powers, nor are they organized armed groups for the purposes of war powers. They simply exclude drug runners. This means, again, there are only two names for what the U.S. government is doing: extrajudicial killing and murder. Finally, the domestic deployments and these boat strikes together reveal a shocking disregard for facts, an alarming disrespect for the rule of law, and contempt for those outside the executive branch of federal government who have used their lawful authorities to keep it in check: the press, Congress, the courts, and the states. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you. My first question for both of you is: a memo signed on 8th of October by Major General Ronald Burkett, the Director of Operations for the Pentagon's National Guard Bureau, setting thresholds for the size, the quick reaction forces that need to be trained in each state to be ready to go by January 1st, 2026, per the memo, and I do have the memo with me. Basically, they set the force size of 350 for the state of Alaska. These folks need to be ready to respond with shields, batons, tasers, and pepper spray to possible civil unrest. And I'm just curious about if we've ever been asked to do this in the past and what any concerns that you might have about all of the states being forced to form these quick response forces to respond immediately to civil unrest.
Well, first and foremost, the comment made by the Trump administration, this is Karen Fair, is that these quick reaction forces deployed to the states was going to be used as training grounds for, you know, other possible other deployments overseas. In the answer to your question about has this been done before, my research reveals never to this extent, and it goes back to the purging of not only top officers, for example, going back to Professor Marr's comments about the extrajudicial killings in the Caribbean, the Southcom commander expressed concerns over that, and he was quickly sidelined and shown the door to retirement. So these actions, these quick reaction forces, if there is any resistance at all by the commanders. Now, you've got to keep in mind that the National Guard is run by the state and then run up to the TAG and the Pentagon. So those are state forces, and they are meant to augment active duty forces when we go to an actual conflict or a declared war. There has been no declared war in these states. They are merely being used to augment Homeland Security, the HHS, in their mission to rid our country of quote-unquote criminal illegal aliens. And again, this is a very novel use of the National Guard in the history of our country.
Professor Maurer.
Yes, thank you, Chair Gray. This is Daniel Maurer again. So I agree with everything that Carl Fair just said, and I would point back to the testimony that you heard earlier in the committee's hearing about the disaster response to Typhoon Halong. That's precisely what you have your National Guard for, in addition to supporting combat troops abroad, either backfilling necessary functions on military bases here in the States or actually performing combat functions alongside active duty troops in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, where Alaskan National Guard troops certainly deployed over the last 20 years. And responding to Typhoon Halong, I think the number was mentioned 200. Unless you're expecting a surge of new residents into Alaska to create this new number of National Guard troops as this quick reaction force, where is that number going to come from? They're going to come from existing stocks, if you will, of troops who are necessary and quite competent at what they've been doing, which is respond to natural disasters and to help their fellow Alaskans. That is what the Guard is designed to do. It's not designed to be a police force. Other nations have militarized police forces. We do not, and we never have. The National Guard should not be used in such a way to police. And that's precisely what has been happening. That's the indirect consequence and perhaps the goal of what the Trump administration has been doing in L.A., with attempts to do it in Chicago, with attempts to do it in Portland. The idea was simply to protect, quote-unquote, protect ICE elements, ICE agents, as they perform a law enforcement function that was being inhibited, according to the administration, by protesters who got violent. Again, there's no doubt that there were violent acts committed during these protests, but under no fair reading of fact can you say that a rebellion is happening, that insurrection is happening. Those are the necessary triggers. The courts were still functioning, the police forces were still functioning. There's no overrunning of civil law enforcement requiring an additional military presence to fix that problem. There was no problem to be fixed with the military. So they can't create a problem, but they can characterize it.
Yes. And in fact, the Posse Comitatus Act prohibits our soldiers from performing law enforcement operations within the United States.
Correct. The only way you can avoid that and circumvent that Posse Comitatus Act is by invoking the Insurrection Act. And no one has, even President Trump, no one has said an insurrection is happening in Portland, in Chicago, in L.A., in Baltimore, in Washington, D.C., or Fairbanks, Alaska. No president has declared the Insurrection Act or invoked the Insurrection Act since 1992 during the L.A. Rodney King riots, when there was actually a request from the state government and the city government to deploy National Guard troops to do law enforcement, and they did. Active duty troops, National Guard troops, performed law enforcement functions alongside L.A. County officers, city police. They did law enforcement. They patrolled, they made arrests, they investigated, they did these things. But that's permitted under the exceptional circumstances of an insurrection. That's not the case here. It is simply an effort to show force, muscular, robust, camouflaged, armed force to chill protests, because this president does not like protests. We can go back to his first administration and look at what he has said about protesters in D.C., who were certainly not violent, and he made suggestions and asked, if it was possible, to shoot them just in the leg. I mean, that to me demonstrates quite clearly this administration's approach to the execution of civil liberties, the very rights that our framers guaranteed to us to use to argue that our government is not doing what we want it to do. That's what these citizens are doing. They disagree with the policy of immigration enforcement, the way they're doing it. They show up to protest. Most are nonviolent and law-abiding. But that doesn't matter if you're the Trump administration. All of it should be chilled. All of it should be prevented. All of it should be hid behind closed doors and not depicted on a TV screen or a Facebook account or an Instagram account. You shouldn't see that. It shouldn't happen. That is what the troops are there to do, to chill, to be a presence patrol, if you will, to chill people from coming out and participating in their constitutional rights. And that is extremely dangerous, especially when it's predicated on flat-out lie. The triggers that these laws are based on aren't being triggered. They're just not happening on the ground. Court after court after court has said as much, and they're the ones closest to the ground, and they're hearing evidence from both sides, and they just don't flat-out believe what the government is saying because there's no evidence of what they're saying. That is not how you make a legal argument. That's not how you run government. That's not how you become transparent with the public that voted you in. It's not how you earn the trust of the public. And by using the military as an arm of this, that will almost inevitably taint the public's trust and faith and confidence in the nonpartisan military, whether it's the National Guard, their neighbors, or the federal troops that come in from a base out in the desert. Trust will go down. We don't want that trust to go down. So there's this inevitable degradation of civil-military relations because the military is being used, as Colonel Fair mentioned, in this politicized way based on no real factual need. That's one of my key concerns.
And I think
I'll have you hold just for a second, Colonel Fair. For the committee's situational awareness, I have reached out to the TAC, to the Adjutant General, Torrin Sachs, about my concerns about the memo from October 8th, and specifically with the 350 Alaskans that need to be part of the Quick Reaction Force and what that force would be used for in Alaska. But I do not have answers at this time.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking that action, Representative Gray.
Thank you, Colonel Fair. It's going to be tricky since you're on the phone. I will call on you. We have a couple of folks in the queue.
Sure.
Perfect. Thank you. Ms. Fair and Professor Maurer, thank you so much for coming to speak to us today. The main crux I want to get to is you're coming and speaking to us up here in Alaska. Outside of a strongly worded resolution, we do not have any powers to act currently on influencing or passing legislation, one, from the Joint Armed Services Committee, but two, as state legislature. Do you agree with that, or what is the purpose of having you here talking about this?
Well, the purpose is that from...
Can you please place yourself within, on the record, Ms. Fair?
Yes, Karen Fair. The main concern is that from within 24 hours of Pete Hegseth's nomination as the Secretary of Defense, he fired every single one of the service's top generals and told them basically they had 15 minutes to pack up their bags. Now, these are individuals who have given their entire life, deployed possibly, you know, 5-6 times in support of our nation, and with great institutional knowledge. And Pete Hegseth brought in his own lawyer, a civilian, made him a Navy lieutenant commander, I believe it could be commander, and told him that he is now in charge of retraining all of the lawyers in the JAG Corps, as I said in my opening remarks, that go all the, have its roots, at least in the Army, all the way back to George Washington. That, along with the purging of general officers who even dare to question, you know, why are we targeting, you know, boats in the Caribbean? That Southcom commander was sidelined and fired. So as far as what Alaska can do is in the rewriting of your statute to update it from BRAC is to include officials from the Pentagon to be a part of discussions within the Joint Armed Services Committee of Alaska, just as they were, as I understand it from Representative Gray, during the time that Lisa Murkowski stood up the BRAC statute. So I think there's an opportunity here where your statute can be rewritten to come up to date with what is going on with how your National Guard troops are going to be handled, and open up a line of communication with the Pentagon, as you had, as I understand, you had previously with BRAC, in order to voice your concerns.
Representative Nelson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Fair, that was quite a lot, and it didn't necessarily answer my question. You know, any new administration has the ability to have a reduction in force. You know, I'm not super familiar with what you were talking about on the purging of officer corps. I know previous administration has gone through over years certain degrees of, I'm going to refer it to Professor Maurer. Can you talk about not only the officer corps, but JAG in particular, and the effects that have happened in this administration, unlike any other?
Yes, to the chair, and Representative Nelson. My name is Dan Maurer again. So, quick point: I disagree with the idea that you, as legislators in the state, don't have the ability to do anything here. You have the ability to influence by reminding the governor of his state powers over the National Guard. You have the power to keep your constituents informed about the state of unrest or lack thereof, thereby downplaying this urgency need that other municipalities are claimed to be experiencing. You have the ability to talk to and influence your federal congressional delegation, which does have the power to put brakes on excessive abusive powers by the president by amending the Insurrection Act, by clarifying what it means to have a rebellion or insurrection, by clarifying under what limited conditions your state governor can be overridden by the president's decision to deploy your own troops or to deploy other troops from other states into your state. You do have the ability to influence. So on the point of JAGS, it is historic. The firing of the lead three-star generals that were in charge of the Army JAG Corps and the Air Force JAG Corps in mid-February 2025, just weeks after Hegseth was confirmed, was blindsided and has never happened before. These are statutorily created positions. They're four-year terms. They're designed to overlap administrations, whether they're the same party or different parties. That's specifically for reinforcing the notion that it's a nonpartisan, apolitical military leadership. They're not supposed to be replaced whenever a new administration comes in. That's not how historically it's ever happened, certainly not with the JAGs. Those JAGs are there to run the institution of the JAG Corps, which is a firm, if you will, of hundreds or thousands of lawyers and legal professionals spread across the world. In every state that has a military installation, there are JAGs. Every state has National Guard JAGs and Reserve Component JAGs and paralegals that are enlisted. Their chief is the PJAG. That PJAG is also the senior lawyer to the Secretary of their services, the Secretary of the Army, Secretary of the Navy, Secretary of the Air Force. They are instrumental in ensuring that when policies that affect the joint force or individual services are thought about, planned, and written at the Pentagon level, or these extraordinary novel uses of force are planned, the JAGs are at the table. That's statutorily. There is a federal law that says no one in the DoD can interfere with the provision of legal advice, independent legal advice from the JAG. And that's a captain JAG all the way up to the three-star JAG. No one in the DoD is permitted to interfere with that. Now, the commanders don't have to follow that advice. It's just advice. It's counsel. JAGs are not in charge. But when JAGs are systematically, degraded, I'll draw your attention to Hegseth's confirmation testimony and in his book, in which he called JAGs JAGOS, based on his very, very limited tactical experience as a National Guard captain in Iraq and Afghanistan 20 years ago, in which he did not have good experiences with his JAGs because many of his fellow officers were being investigated for war crimes. That's a fact. So his view of JAGs is like this, this external dragon comes in and is there to undercut the knighthood of the military, right? The dragons are there to disable the true might of the warrior ethos. That's not what JAGs do. JAGs ensure that when plans are made, when operations are conducted, that those plans are consistent with law. That to me is common sense. That to me is absolutely necessary.
As Professor Maurer
is
saying,
Ms. Fair,
okay.
I'm going to let Professor Maurer finish just a moment.
Okay.
Continue.
So when those JAGs, or this PJAGs, the three stars, are fired and replaced by lower ranking National Guard leaders, and no disrespect to National Guard, but National Guard leaders have never been historically placed in charge of the active duty JAG Corps. There's a distinct difference. If you look at the current Army TJAG, the amount of active duty time he's had is like 7 or 8 years. That's not insignificant, but it's not the 35 years of his predecessor. His predecessor was replaced because he was, quote unquote, would be a roadblock. That's coming from Hegseth now. And he would be a roadblock to the things that the administration would want to do. That roadblock was the legal advisor to the Joint Special Operations Command when they took out bin Laden. And yet, according to Hegseth, that lawyer was too much of a woke warrior, non-warrior. That is an unbelievable mischaracterization of what that officer has done in his career and for this country. And it sent a shockwave down the chain, at least within the JAG Corps, when you know that your senior leader, who is massively respected, who has served multiple administrations across political parties, has been elevated to the senior position in the JAG Corps, is removed well before his term of office ends because he would be, quote unquote, a roadblock, what do you think that sends to the captains and the majors and the lieutenant colonels who are advising the tactical level units down in Los Angeles, the Marine unit that's sent into LA to, quote unquote, help ICE, or the National Guard JAGs that are there to advise commanders that are going to Oregon or Illinois or Baltimore or wherever? It's going to chill their advice. They're going to be more resistant to saying, wait a minute, we have a legal objection here, because they don't want to be put on blast by the Secretary of Defense or Laura Loomer, who will then say that they're woke and put up their biographical information on a website and literally destroy their lives. So they're not going to say anything. And I don't necessarily blame them for not. They're in a very, very hard place. And that's exactly why we don't do this. We don't purge when a new administration comes in. They are supposed to be non-political. They're supposed to be nonpartisan. And when you start shifting them around and complaining about them and saying they're not important and saying that they're inhibiting, you know, actual military operations, you are undercutting the rule of law. You're undercutting respect for it. You're undercutting the provision of it. You're undercutting the follow through of it. And nothing good will come of it.
Thank you. Professor Maurer, I'll note for the record that we've been joined by Representative Elise Galvin. Ms. Fair, you had something you wanted to add, and then we'll go to Representative Nelson.
Yes, just to bolster what Professor Maurer is saying is what has happened is they're waiting for new heads of the services to be appointed. However, this plan risks undermining the independence of military legal advice, and that's a principle that has been protected by Title 10 since 1956 and reinforced in 2004 when Congress made it illegal for Pentagon officials to interfere with JAG's ability to give independent advice. And also, sir, in answer to your question, that in each administration, the president has the authority to pick his own people. Yes, that's political appointees. I served in the Army General Counsel's office, and so I was a JAG, but you're very correct. The Army General Counsel can be selected at the pleasure of the president, but yet a JAG officer remains apolitical. By this effort to retrain JAGs to interpret the laws of armed conflict less restrictively, the plan blurs the line between lawful and unlawful conduct in war. This increases the risk of violations of the Geneva Conventions and other international humanitarian law standards. When you weaken the accountability and oversight, it could reduce prosecution for battlefield crimes. The whole reason behind why we have the Geneva Conventions was because of the atrocities that came out of World War II. And under the current administration, what it is leading to is that the way that you treat your enemy in turn is how a soldier who is taken captive could be treated. I was the litigation manager for Abu Ghraib, and never before had we seen a scandal as big as that, and the prosecution of the soldiers involved was a high priority of the commanding general of the multinational corps in Iraq. The U.S. military's conduct is scrutinized globally, weakening this legal oversight, sets a precedent for our allies, eroding international norms and damaging the U.S.'s reputation on the world stage as a proponent of the rule of law. So we have never in our history seen an apolitical branch of JAG Corps totally eroded from the inside out by an administration telling, for example, in the Army, a TJAG who had 35 years of service that he had 15 minutes to get out of his office because of his substandard performance. And that goes back to what Professor Morrow said. Just think of the chilling effect. When you're a young captain in the JAG Corps, the TJAG is like, you know, a god to you. And to see him unceremoniously just neutered on the national stage just sends a chilling effect through every single echelon of lawyers below that TJAG. And now we await the confirmation of the new heads of the respective JAG Corps. And we fought for a long time to have the TJAG to be a three-star general. Well, now they're saying that that rank doesn't matter. You know, they don't have to be a general officer. Perhaps they could be a colonel or whoever they choose. And what's even more troubling is that a civilian attorney has been given a Navy commission, Mr. Hegseth's personal lawyer, and it is his mission now to retrain JAGs, and in the Army's case, JAGs that go back all the way to the Second Continental Congress. So it is very alarming. It is probably one of the biggest scandals that we have seen throughout the military, that now we are going to get yes men and yes women to give advice that is totally outside the norms of the law of armed conflict, which is based in the Geneva Conventions and is a moral code by which the U.S. has conducted its operations overseas for hundreds of years. And from personal experience in Iraq, JAGs were an integral part of the targeting decisions, and a lot of that calculation had to do with the amount of collateral damage, or CDE, that would be allowed. And without that advice, and without that type of oversight given to the commander, you could have atrocious war crimes that occur that will ultimately put us on the world stage as a laughingstock, as did the Abu Ghraib scandal. And so, yes, sir, I agree that the president has the right to change out the political appointees, but not the JAG Corps, who are supposed to be apolitical and serve the commander with frank, based in law advice. And as a JAG, I would always frankly give my advice, sir, you can do A or B or C, but I submit that you choose option B, and this is the reason why. And commanders who are worth their weight in salt will always rely on their JAG, because JAGs are not roadblocks. Good JAGs are always in the business of getting to yes with the commander. And that goes all the way up to the top lawyer on the joint staff, and all of the combatant commands. Like, say, take for example CENTCOM right now, where the, as Professor Morrow said, what amounts to extrajudicial killings are happening in international waters, where previously in our history, the Coast Guard would have the mission of going aboard those ships, seizing the drugs, arresting the people. Instead, I think we're on our 16th or 17th strike in the Caribbean, with the biggest buildup in the Caribbean, including an aircraft carrier outside, stationed within that CENTCOM area of responsibility.
Thank you, Ms. Fair, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So quite a few couple of things. First off, as was noted, there really isn't anything that the JASC can.
I'm going to interrupt right there and just answer that question. We've been talking about what JASC does. JASC interfaces with the DOD. And to say that we have no place talking to the federal government because we're state legislators, I think would be, we would need to return to the second part of this agenda to say what's the purpose of JASC if it's not to interface with DOD and to talk about what the Alaskan people, we are the representatives of the Alaskan people. We communicate with DOD what the Alaskan people feel on the ground. When we are told by this memo from Major General Ronald Burkett, signed October 8, 2025, that Alaska must prepare 350 quick response force to be able to respond on the streets to civil unrest with pepper spray, with tasers, with batons, and that we added 350 right away. I think that it's important that is absolute meaning of this committee. We are here to say, yeah. We have questions about that. We have questions about this new quick response force that needs to be able to respond on the streets of Anchorage at a moment's notice to civil unrest. We have questions about when in history would that have been something that would be used in Alaska? Why are we doing that? So I think if you say, we're state legislators, we have no right to comment on this, then why do we have a JASC committee?
If I can respond.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Lyndon Nelson. Before you were talking, what I was saying was that outside of resolutions, which is messages, which is communication, at the end of the day, the Department of Defense or Department of War is still going to move forward because of we don't have oversight power over them. If something like this were to happen, the president, as was noted, can still activate the National Guard. And now, speaking specifically about that, now I haven't seen that email, so I don't know in depth about it, but, you know, we're always in a changing environment. So having, say, a QRF to have riot shields or different things like that, I mean, that's part of why the National Guard gets activated, is disaster relief, riot control, I mean, during the civil rights, even though the governor of Arkansas at Little Rock was opposed to bringing the National Guard, President Eisenhower still came in and activated them to enforce civil rights standards, civil rights law. So we're always in a changing environment. Having a QRF form, I mean, that just might be where we're at, just in our changing world, in our changing environment. What I was trying to go and talk about is that we as JASC, outside of resolutions, outside of talking, do not have any legislative power, or you and me as representatives don't have any legislative power in order to enact what we're talking about here today. That is up on the federal side, which we can communicate with, but we do not have any oversight capabilities. We do not have anything to enforce the standards of what's happening, because that's just not our left and right limit.
Representative Nelson, do you believe that we are at a disadvantage right now because we don't have this quick response force? You were saying that you could see reasons why we would need that. Do you think that we're at a disadvantage by not having it?
I don't know what you're trying to get at.
What I'm trying to get at is that you're saying that you could see a good reason for us putting this force together. Do you foresee the need for that force in the coming future?
I look at it and see how fast what happened in Western Alaska, and not having something specifically of riot control out in Western Alaska, but the need to have a quick response force in the National Guard to respond to emergencies like that would be justified.
I heard today that we got 200 soldiers involved in the response to Typhoon Halong immediately. So to me, I think we are able to do a quick response. That's what I learned today. And so that's why I think it's important that we ask questions about a 350 force that needs to be ready to go by January 1st. Professor Maurer, can I continue with
you? Thank you, Chair Wright. So just a point of clarification, President Eisenhower activated the Arkansas National Guard to stand it down so that he could deploy the 101st Airborne Division into Little Rock, because the National Guard, along with the governor, were refusing to protect the Little Rock line. The National Guard was not coming to the rescue, the 101st was. And here's the legal authority to do that was the invocation of the Insurrection Act, which I don't think anyone would argue was not well-founded, that it was based on factual need under the circumstances. When you have a governor and a state legislature refusing to follow what the Supreme Court said, this is desegregating the school safely, and they just weren't going to do it. The only way to do that, the only way to enforce that Supreme Court law, interpretation of the highest law of the land, in that case, was to stand down the National Guard of Arkansas. Now, to your point about quick reaction forces, I 100% agree. Have a quick reaction force to do exactly what they did in Typhoon Halong. That's have a quick reaction force, but that's not what the order said. The order is not the disaster relief. It is specifically designed to deal with things like what happened in Los Angeles and in Portland and potentially in Chicago. It is meant to be an augmentee police force. And that is fine if it's invoked by law, not by edict. It has to be triggered by law. That's the Insurrection Act. And the president has not invoked the Insurrection Act. That is the only way that the National Guard can be used to police fellow Americans. And that's precisely what these quick reaction forces would be doing. Whether the president wants to call it that or not, that in fact is what's happening, and that's what a court has said it was happening in L.A. So it's important that we clarify and be very specific about what this memo says and what it does not say. It does not say, hey, here's a good idea. Have a QRF in all the states so that you can respond to the next typhoon or earthquake or massive flooding. Not that at all. It is precisely to do what they're doing in L.A., which has been found to be a violation of the Posse Comitatus Act. So if we all care about the rule of law, that means every person in government at the federal level, at the state level, and all down below have to care about it, and they have to enforce it. And that's what checks and balances are for. You're a check on your state governor. Your courts are a check on both you and the state governor. The state governor has a role in your court system. The president is checked by Congress. Congress checks the president. The courts check both. The president nominates members for the court. Senate confirms those members. It's checks and balances. So to say that, well, this is not our lane, this decision about employing the military in our state, not our lane, I think that's poppycock. It is your lane. You are a legislative body representing the people. You also have another tier of you in D.C. To say that you don't have influence with them, I think, denigrates your ability to do anything. Of course you have the ability to influence what they're saying to other members of Congress and to the president. If there's pushback from you, there's an ability to push back there. And there is where they enact an amendment to the Insurrection Act. There is where they cut off funding for military operations that break the law. That's the check. But it starts, I think, with all due respect, at a local level. You both have said, I think, earlier in the hearing that you all have responsibilities and access to things locally that your Congress members in Congress do not. They see things from a different side of the world than you do. They need you to inform them of what the public sentiment is. They need you to inform them about the nature of the strife, of the civil unrest. They need you to do those things, to help inform. And so I think you as a state legislature are an integral gear in that process of checks and balances, even though you're not sitting in Washington, D.C. That's a layperson's opinion sitting in Ohio, but that's my perspective. That's what I would say to the Ohio legislature, too.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Yeah, I appreciate that. Professor Maurer, it's good to see another Fort Leonard Wood alumni out here talking. I wanted to go back before we had this a side road. You were talking about Secretary Hegseth's rhetoric. And I wanted to kind of look at that and compare between what his rhetoric is and your comparison on systematic lawlessness, because I want to see how that compares between systematic lawlessness and how that comparison ignores rules of engagement and really kind of the standards that were set up on military.
Professor Maurer, I'm going to just read a bit from your recent article in Just Security and then have you comment, because it's exactly in line with Representative Nelson. In your recent article in justsecurity.org, you quoted Secretary Hegseth as decrying the military's, quote, stupid rules of engagement, end quote. And then you went on to quote from his speech at Quantico, Virginia on September 30th, "We fight to win. We unleash overwhelming and punishing violence on the enemy. We also don't fight with stupid rules of engagement. We untie the hands of our warfighters to intimidate, demoralize, hunt, and kill the enemies of our country. No more politically correct and overbearing rules of engagement, just common sense, maximum lethality, and authority for warfighters. You kill people and break things for a living. You are not politically correct and don't necessarily belong always in polite society," end quote.
And if I could be recognized
Professor Maurer. It's going to be Professor Maurer now.
So I felt insulted to the nth degree when I heard his comment and when I read his testimony and saw his testimony in the Senate confirmation hearing and all the things that he said prior to his nomination. It's just flatly wrong. It's morally wrong and technically incorrect. He doesn't understand what rules of engagement are because he has so little experience dealing with them. He doesn't know where they come from. He doesn't understand that rules of engagement reflect three different things. They reflect policy at the highest levels. So if you're fighting a counterinsurgency operation where winning the hearts and minds of the locals is really, really critically important to your success so that you're not creating more insurgents and you have to turn the public's tide against the insurgents, then you don't want to be super duper aggressive all the time, even though you could be. You are restraining yourself. You're respecting the locals. You're not being overbearing. You are respecting. That's a policy choice based on the kind of conflict it is. It's also based on specific mission requirements. What's the nature of the threat that the troops face? What is the nature of the enemy? What are they doing? Not law. The third thing is law. The third thing is the red line that no rules of engagement can ever cross, and that is law of war. It is a baseline. It is something that you train on. You get trained on it for decades. It is part of DoD doctrine, policy, regulations, and in statute. And there's a war crimes statute, federal war crimes statute, 18 U.S.C. 2441, that makes it a crime to violate the Geneva Conventions, because we've ratified those conventions. That's part of our law, too, along with the federal statutes and the Constitution. Those treaties are part of supreme law of the land. So to disparage those things is just, one, immature, two, unprofessional, three, completely divorced from reality. That's not what we do. And so that rhetoric, as you called it, it's rhetoric. It's dangerous rhetoric. And I like to believe that the vast majority of those 800 senior leaders sitting in that room in Quantico knew that what he was spouting off was nonsense. But it's dangerous because that message wasn't limited to just those 800, right? He broadcast it everywhere. Every troop saw it. And not every troop understands the nature of rules of engagement or laws of armed conflict, even though they're trained on it. Many share his opinion that, oh, these rules are handcuffs and all we want to do is, you know, kill people and break things. But just because you can do that doesn't mean you're allowed to do that. Doesn't mean you should do that. We have these rules in place for a reason. It's hard to fight conflict. It's dangerous. You're at risk. You're putting young people in places where they are asked to do things that are superhuman in nature and to act with restraint when they need to, or act with murderous rage when needed, to get outside their normal intuitions about what they should do morally. You're asking them to kill people. That is dangerous. And if you don't, if you give them these weapons and you give them the authority to do that, and you don't create constraints based on reasoned law, then what you have is barbarism. What you have is ISIS beheading people. You have Russia bombing apartment complexes. That's not how you fight war. War is terrible. But if you're going to fight it, you fight it with rules. And those rules may make it more difficult and challenging in some places and sometimes, but it's the right thing to do. And as troops, you're taught that. And it's important to follow that. And my last example here to illustrate my concern about that rhetoric and the disparagement of rules of engagement in law of war is exactly what's happening in the Caribbean and the Eastern Pacific. No lawyer, no military lawyer that I know of, talked to, or have ever been with, would ever agree that there is any legal justification, legal authority under either domestic law or international law to kill those people on those boats. No matter how bad they are, no matter how dangerous they are, they are criminals. Criminals are dangerous, but we arrest criminals, and we prosecute criminals, and we put criminals in prison. We don't just execute them because we can. And that is the attitude or philosophy of lawmaking that Hegseth has. We can and we will. And he's pretty much said that. We can and we will. That is dangerous, and that is unprecedented in modern American history for our civilian leadership in the DOD. And I refuse to call it the Department of War because that is not what it's called by statute. And they don't have the authority to change its name. And by changing its name, it reorients the attitude. And I struggle to find the right words to describe how inane it is and dangerous at the same time. It is incredibly dangerous. And so this rhetoric has real consequences, coupled with what Colonel Fair was talking about earlier with the systematic removal of the senior JAGs and the chilling effect. We don't know what legal advice we've ever given to the drone operator who's firing those missiles, or to the captain of the ship that has the drone on its platform, or to anyone in between. Maybe no legal advice was given because maybe no lawyers were in the room. And that is dangerous to any republic that says we follow the rule of law. We are a country of the rule of law, not the rule of dictate or the rule of men. We have to follow law, and the experts in the law are the lawyers. And when the lawyers are removed from the room, bad things happen. Period.
Thank you, Professor Maurer. I just want to do a quick fact check of something that Colonel Fair said earlier. As of today, the military has conducted 19 strikes on boats in international waters and killed 76 people without a trial. We're at 3:00. I want to be respectful of everyone's time. I want to ask if there's any questions from our civilian members.
And if not, then we have Representative Stutes. Her hand has been up for a long time. I think it might have been left up from earlier, but I wanted to offer her the floor.
Oh, you're very kind, and you were exactly right. It was left out from earlier, but what an incredibly interesting committee meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Stutes. And last question, Representative Nelson.
I appreciate it. Just to circle on the drone strikes on the war on drugs, we talked about this for a little bit. You know, I think rules of engagements have always been dynamic. You know, I've never seen them as handcuffs, but really as flexible, you know, tailored to the mission and theater. So specifically when talking about these strikes, I look at the precedent that was set under the Obama administration. I think they had something over 500 strikes on terrorist targets, and not just under the congressional use of military force in Iraq and Afghanistan, but in Yemen and in Pakistan, and even going against, I think it was 3 or 4 U.S. citizens that were killed under the Obama administration due to those drone strikes. So do you see those at all conflicting, or do you see that precedent continuing? What do you think on that? And I'll open that to either Ms. Fair or Professor Maurer.
We'll go to Professor Maurer.
Well,
thank you. To the chair.
If I could be recognized, this is Colonel Fair.
Colonel Fair, we're going to go to Professor Maurer first. Professor Maurer first.
Sure. Go to
Thank you. Point of clarification, and it's an important one, all of those drone strikes, we can disagree, and I probably have disagreements about when and where and how many of those drone strikes were operated, but they were not inconsistent with the law. All of them, whether Afghanistan or Iraq, Yemen or elsewhere, or against an unlawful enemy belligerent, quote-unquote, like an American citizen who's essentially in the Taliban or ISIS, those were all permitted under domestic law. They were all permitted under domestic law. They all fell within the auspices of the 2001 Authorization for the Use of Military Force, which said globally, any individual, group, nation, or other that is associated with those who conducted the 9/11 attacks or those who supported the 9/11 attacks is fair game. And that probably unreasonably over time did expand to include derivatives of those groups. But nonetheless, no one said, no charges were brought, no impeachment hearing was held to say that he exceeded his authorization under the use of military force. Maybe bad policy, maybe not helpful militarily. I don't know. Maybe something it was. But it definitely had domestic legal authority. Now, international legal authority, arguably, that whole conflict fell within our lawful authority as a nation state to combat a non-state armed group, ISIS, Taliban, Al-Qaeda, et cetera, et cetera. That is a legitimate use of self-defense. So if they're an organized armed group, as I mentioned earlier, if they're an organized armed group fighting a non-international armed conflict, they're fair game. As if they were a military unit fighting far from the front line, they're still fair game. Or if they're individually directly participating in hostilities. Most, if not all of those cases, there was an argument made that they fell into one of those two categories. But none of that applies here in the Caribbean or the Eastern Pacific, because there is no authorization for the use of military force. The 2001 AOF does not cover narco-terrorism. It just doesn't, and you can't read it in any other way. So there's no congressional authority. Presidential authority under Article 2 without Congress getting involved is very limited. It's essentially to repel an invasion or deal with a civil war. There's no invasion. There's no civil war. So there's no self-defense argument that it just triggered the president's ability to start launching strikes. Even if we're in a non-armed state, international armed conflict with these cartels and their members, again, those strikes are unlawful, because even if we could do that in a previous conflict, it's a previous conflict. And again, they're not DPHing, directly participating in hostilities, or organized armed groups, which means they're only civilian criminals. And the only way you can deal with civilian criminals lawfully is to arrest them and prosecute them and incarcerate them. The rules of engagement don't allow you to breach the law of war. Again, like you said, they reflect the mission, they reflect policy, but like I said, at a minimum, they cannot breach that red line of international law, and that's precisely what they're doing. Regardless of how motivated we are to fix the drug problem, no matter how dangerous we think they are as criminals, no matter how deadly the drug scourge is, they're still criminals. Nothing they're doing elevates them to a category of people who can be targeted with military force outside of a courtroom. So it doesn't matter what the ROE says. It's just wrong. If the ROE says it's permitted, it's still violating international law, which makes it wrong, which makes it an unlawful order for anyone to be following.
Thank you, Professor Maurer. I'm going to close the committee, but I did want to ask one question of Colonel Fair before we go. And the reason why is because I've already had some coverage saying that this was going to be sort of a Democratic-led attack on the Trump administration. So just for clarification, Colonel Fair, can you reveal your party affiliation and who you voted for in the presidential election? Colonel Fair.
Yes, Fair. Republican.
Oh, good.
I voted Republican and for Trump.
Thank you. This Committee of Situational Awareness, after our inability to meet with the TAG in person, Senator Kawasaki and I have sent a letter to General Sachs expressing our concerns about the rapid formation of a quick response force and its potential use in Alaska. Is there any final comments from anybody? Okay. Well,
I have
thank
a
you very
couple.
Much. Oh, okay.
I have a couple.
Colonel Fair, a couple quick comments.
Number one is that I was nominated by my West Point class of 85 to write Congress. Against the nomination of Pete Hegseth. The reason that he coined the term jag off is because when he was a platoon leader in Afghanistan, he asked the JAG if he could use RPGs against human beings, which is not proportional and is against the law of war. And he also disobeyed his own commander on the use of force in combat. He has led no more than a platoon and otherwise than a Fox News broadcast personnel. So in closing, we have someone in charge who stood up before all the generals and their enlisted advisors on September 30th and berated them, having only achieved to be the leader of the lowest unit in the military, which is the platoon. And so by his limited experience and by being short-sighted, I just pray that we do not have an international incident. As already the British have called us out for the strikes in the Caribbean, but as an operator, one mistake that is made could mark our country forever. And that's, I'll end with that. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you so much, Colonel Fair, and thank you, Colonel Maurer, and thank you for your service. It's the day after Veterans Day. Thank you to General Baez, Colonel DeCalis, Colonel Dole, Captain Nelson, and a happy belated Veterans Day. And
thank you very much.
That concludes this JASC meeting at 3:11 p.m.
The conference has ended.